Funding for Think is made possible by SMU's Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Is China's one-party government the engine propelling it toward a prosperous future or an anchor that chains it to the oppressive ideas of the past? Like virtually everything else in 21st century China, the answers to those questions are complicated, dynamic, and critical to determining whether or not the country will develop a true democratic system of government. Unfortunately, guiding China's future requires understanding its painful history, a step that for now seems possible for only a small but courageous segment of its enormous population. Philip Pepin has just completed a 7-year stint as chief of the Washington Post's Beijing Bureau. His new book is called Out of Mao's Shadow, The Struggle for the Soul of a New China. Phil, welcome to Think.
Thanks for having me.
You write that the Chinese people are accomplices in their country's forgetting. How exactly do they erase the recent past from consideration?
Well, the erasing begins with the party. The party has tried to define history for the public because it wants to maintain a sanitized version of events that hides the disasters of the party's rule, the Cultural Revolution, some of Mao's other violent purges, and also the 1989 massacre. When I write that the Chinese people are accomplices, I don't mean all of the Chinese people, but certainly a segment of the population, and in the case of the Cultural Revolution, a large segment of the population wants to forget it as well.
Yeah, before even Tiananmen in 1989, in 1981, history was effectively rewritten and sort of published and put out to everyone in China.
Well, you could say it was rewritten or it was written for the first time, mm-hmm. officially. The government issued this was after Mao Zedong's death. The government issued a verdict on his career and on the Cultural Revolution. They decided that he was 70% right and 30% wrong. And that acknowledged the Cultural Revolution was a disaster, but it didn't want to open up a process of healing or a process of discussion about the Cultural Revolution. It didn't want people to be distracted from what it saw as the primary task of economic development. And so it set limits on what could be said about the Cultural Revolution, and that became the official history that is taught in schools and portrayed in the media right now.
Phil, how much do you think people's acquiescence to that rule has to do with the fact that so many people did things under Mao that today they know were wrong?
Well, I think that's a major part of it. You know, even today, you have offices and workplaces where some of the people who were inflicting violence or even torturing people are working alongside people that they tortured or people who suffered. But, you know, I don't want to push this point too far. I think it's also important to remember that despite this effort to define history by the party, and despite a large part of the population wanting to forget it, society is beginning to recover it. I think ordinary people, especially people who were born after these events, are beginning to do research and make sure that this doesn't disappear completely. And I think this is an important step for moving the country forward.
Has it been an element of Chinese culture sort of throughout history to frown on dwelling on what has passed?
Yeah, there's that strain in Chinese history, but there's also an important strain of pride in the past. You know, this is a country with a 5,000-year history, as they will often tell you, and there's great pride in China in the past. And so the efforts of people like the documentary filmmaker named Hu Jie, who I met, who spent 5 years of his life writing and doing research about a woman who was executed during the Cultural Revolution, losing his job, becoming under investigation by the state security services. You know, those kinds of efforts, there's a tradition of this in China and in Chinese history.
Yeah, she was executed when she was just 36 years old, and she had been through all kinds of problems and had become quite mentally ill by the time she was finally put to death. And that's a really interesting story because the filmmaker had a hard time often convincing people to sort of go on the record and talk about their friend who was executed.
Yeah, so this woman, her name was Lin Zhao. She was the only student at Peking University in the 1950s who refused to write a confession during one of Mao's first major purges of party critics. She ended up in prison, and then was executed, as you say, at age 36. She left something behind. She while she was in prison, she wrote about her predicament with her own blood, and the party saved these writings and tried to use this as evidence against her. And when this filmmaker heard about it, you know, he was fascinated. He had never heard anything like it, and he set out to find it. But many of the people, you're right, many of the people he interviewed, many of her classmates, they didn't want to go. They didn't want to go there. They didn't want to relive those memories. Many of them had suffered themselves as well. They'd spent often decades in the labor camps, and they didn't want to talk about it anymore. They had, they wanted. They were already pretty old, many of them, and they wanted to move on with their enjoy the what they had left of their lives, really.
What about for you working as a journalist? I'm wondering whether it was easier for you to ask colleagues or neighbors about the Cultural Revolution as Phil, their colleague or neighbor, or as a journalist.
I think it was easier for me as a journalist, to be honest. As a journalist, you have an excuse to ask these questions. as a neighbor, as a friend, sometimes it can be sensitive to bring this up, and I think you feel the sensitivities that many of the Chinese people feel. And so, as an ordinary person, I didn't often bring it up with friends unless it was you found yourself in a very appropriate sort of time to do that. But as a journalist, you could always ask these questions. I was quite surprised, actually, and most people were willing to talk about it. As long as, there were sometimes concerns about whether you'd be writing about them, but you'd find that anywhere, I think.
Philip P. Pan is my guest. He's former Beijing bureau chief for The Washington Post. His new book is called Out of Mao's Shadow, The Struggle for the Soul of a New China. How effective are government attempts these days to censor the Internet?
Oh, this is one of the major battlefields, really, of the struggle for the country's future. The Internet is the only free media right now in China. Everything else is owned by the state. But the government tries very hard to censor it. It employs a vast network of investigators and propagandists who actually post material on the Internet as well. And they try to block sites that contain objectionable material. They also put pressure on Internet companies to delete and prevent from being posted sensitive what they consider objectionable, politically objectionable material. But in truth, if you're a young person there with some limited technical know-how, you can get around the censors fairly easily. And so any information that you want to get, you can get. The real success of the government has been making it, putting so much other material on the Internet and in the media that most people aren't interested in looking for more material than what's immediately available. That little hassle of having to go through the technical, jump through the technical loops to get around the blocks isn't worth it for most people.
Although if you speak another language, you have much better luck in getting past the censors.
Well, of course, yes. The most material in English isn't blocked at all, actually. Even, when I first arrived, actually, in China in 2000, the Washington Post website was blocked. It's no longer blocked, neither is the New York Times, and most of the English language sites, because they realize it's not necessary to do that. Most of the population doesn't speak English.
I was surprised to read that you say the government these days largely stays out of the workplace and out of people's personal lives, at least compared with how it used to be. Can you talk about what's changed?
Sure. Basically, in the transition from socialism to capitalism, the government privatized a large segment of the economy, basically. And in doing so, it retreated. The party itself retreated from the workplace. In the past, everything depended on your work unit. You needed to get permission to get married. You needed to get the work unit's permission to travel, to move. But now, with the market economy, the government is really not able to do that anymore. And it realizes that trying to do that would be a disaster for the economy.
Does the economy and the fact that it's doing so well, do you think, keep people happier than they ought to be with their government?
Yes, this is the key to the success of this one-party state. I like to say that there's a vast experiment going on there about whether capitalism and authoritarianism can coexist. And there's an assumption in the West, and certainly in U.S. foreign policy, that economic growth leads automatically to political liberalization, that free markets lead to free societies, but China has shown us that isn't necessarily so. And I think the main reason this party has succeeded in staying in power is because it has embraced capitalism and has allowed economic growth to occur.
So, in other words, it comes down to the economy. As long as people are doing better themselves, they can turn a blind eye to everything else.
Well, this is what the party hopes. They're hoping that by delivering prosperity – People will ignore the fact that their political rights are still limited. Thus far, it's been a successful gamble. I think the pressures are beginning to build for change, though. This party has shown it can deliver economic growth, but can a one-party system deliver other public goods? Can it deliver a good health care? Can it protect the environment? Can it enforce labor standards? These are all things that it's having trouble doing, and these are all things that the public is beginning to clamor for.
Yeah, and I guess the irony for the party is that some of the elevations in living standards have made Chinese people aware of things even greater than what they already have that they're missing out on.
Yes, part of it is the disparity between rich and poor that's been allowed to emerge. That has caused frustration, largely because many of the people believe that the richest, at least, and many of the, even the upper middle class, have gotten there because of their connections to party officials. This is the form of capitalism that has emerged in China, really, that in this transition from socialism to capitalism, when new markets emerged, political officials with access to these markets could make a fortune, and then they could give that to their, grant access to these markets to their friends and to their relatives. And so people who have been left out, even though they're doing better as well, they are beginning to get frustrated with this unfair playing field.
We talked about internet censorship and the attempts to control that. I'm wondering about things like TV shows and movies from the West. For example, you could watch enough movies from the U.S. and get a sense of what a labor union might be and things like that.
Yes, this is definitely an important battlefield too, the media. I think they've almost completely given up on trying to limit the influx of foreign films and television. They still have limits on the films that can be shown in the theaters, but almost everything is available now on the internet or on DVDs, pirated editions, of which are on sale on the streets everywhere. The more interesting battle, I think, is the battle going on in the state press itself. The state newspapers are owned by the government and they're run by the party, but the journalists themselves, even if they're party members, they aspire to be more than propagandists. I write in the book about a young newspaper editor who basically modeled his newspaper after the Washington Post and tried to conduct real journalism, partly because he believed in it, but partly because it would also be a successful business strategy. With market forces, the newspapers are competing for readers and advertisers, and a scarce commodity is real investigative journalism.
Yeah, this was the Southern Metropolis Daily, which, among other things, had stories that were much more daring about the realities of SARS when that was going on.
Yes, SARS was a great story to cover because you saw so many heroes really emerge. One was the editor of this newspaper who really tried to push the limits of the SARS coverage and eventually gets punished for it. But the other was a doctor. The doctor is a surgeon at a military hospital in Beijing named Jiang Yanyong, who was the man who really blew the whistle on the cover-up, exposed it to the international media, and forced the government to back down. Within days of his letter to the media, the minister of health was fired, and the mayor of Beijing was fired, and the government completely changed course. And for me, it was an example of how one individual can really change the course of history.
Philippe Pan is my guest. He is former Beijing bureau chief for the Washington Post. His new book is called Out of Mao's Shadow, The Struggle for the Soul of a New China. You can join us by calling 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think is made possible by SMU's Master of Liberal Studies program, a way to keep your greatest two tools, creativity and curiosity, sharp. Details online at smu.edu/MLS.
You're You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is former Beijing bureau chief for the Washington Post, Philip P. Pan. His new book is called Out of Mao's Shadow, The Struggle for the Soul of a New China. If you'd like to join us, you can send email to think@kera.org, or you can call 1-800-933-5372. One of the people that we were talking about before the break was Cheng Yizong, who was the editor-in-chief of the Southern Metropolis Daily. As you mentioned, he was jailed for his work and ultimately, thanks in large part to public pressure, was finally released.
Yes, that's right. After he was put in prison, he was put in prison because local authorities were upset by an article he published in which he exposed abuses of one of the detention systems that's across China. The government eventually, under pressure because of this article, abolished these detention centers. But the police officials and the local officials whose careers were hurt by this wanted to take revenge, and they found an excuse to arrest him on corruption charges, and they held him for several months. But while he was in prison, his colleagues in the press around the country began to campaign for his release, and the public pressure at one point, I guess, was too great for the leadership. They decided to release him, but to keep two of his colleagues from the business side of the newspaper in prison.
And he's still not allowed to work for a newspaper again?
No, he'll never be allowed to work for a state newspaper unless there's a serious political change in China. He's now working as an editor of, I think, Sports Illustrated right now. You know, he sort of left, he was a party member. He had been an idealist. He did believe that, and working with the state press, you could change the party and make it better. Now he's been sort of kicked out, and he's sort of left with a few options as a citizen and if he wants to help move the country forward now.
How aware are most Chinese of the standards of human rights there as opposed to in other parts of the world?
Well, that's a tough question. You know, whenever you talk about most Chinese, it's always difficult in a country like that. But I think generally people... are aware that people in other countries are allowed to elect their leaders. People are aware that in other countries the courts are more independent than they are in China. They're not independent at all in China, so they understand that, I think. And I think the numbers who understand this are growing. The question is, do people care? There's a significant portion of the middle class, at least, who has been willing to look the other way, that they don't mind these limits on political freedom, partly because they understand the cost of challenging the government, and they don't think it makes sense to do that personally, partly because as long as their families are doing well economically, that's good enough for them. On the other hand, you know, as we've seen in recent months, when the state sort of rubs up against people, when it begins to affect people's lives and infringe on their lives, these people are willing to stand up and challenge the state. We've seen this in cities across the country, in environmental protests, labor protests, and I expect we'll be seeing more.
You make such an interesting point in the book, which is that, at least in an academic sense, there are some defensible reasons that the Communist Party might use to say this is why it makes sense for us to have a single-party state. Would you talk about what those might be?
Well, they have many defensible reasons, and number one is the economy. You know, I call China the most successful authoritarian state around right now. And partly it's because of 25 years of pretty steady and very rapid economic growth. They've lifted 200 to 300 million people out of poverty, and they've been able to make the transition from socialism to capitalism in a pretty smooth way, certainly smoother than occurred in the former Soviet Union and in Eastern Europe. They could make a strong case, as you say, that this is a better system for our nation. You know, this is too big a country to manage with a democratic system, especially because we have no history of democracy in China. They could make this case, but they don't. And instead, they argue that they are also a democracy. And I think that says something about how powerful the ideals of democracy are. They cannot just deny completely and say that, we are against democracy. They have to sort of put themselves up in that role as well.
Are they fooling anybody?
They're not fooling many people, I think. I think most people understand what the definition of the word democracy is, and a one-party state isn't a democracy. But I think they don't need to fool a lot of people. The people who are supporting them don't need to be fooled. They understand the bargain that they're making, I think.
Do you think, Phil, that it would be possible now to change the government substantially to a multi-party system or a democracy without violence or at least disruption to the rapid growth that we've seen in China?
Sure. I think it's definitely possible. We've seen democratization occur in other nations without violence. In Taiwan, in South Korea, you saw a process where democracy emerged from authoritarian systems, and certainly in other parts of the world. It may be a little bit rougher in China, but I think the old excuse that the Chinese people aren't ready, that there would be too much fighting, there'd be too much violence, I don't think that holds very well anymore. I think the major risk, perhaps, is that if there is a significant push for democracy, if the those in power are determined to dig in their heels and resort to violence, I think that's a very real possibility.
Philip P. Pan is my guest. His book is called Out of Mao's Shadow, The Struggle for the Soul of a New China. Our number is 1-800-933-5372. Let's speak to Joe in Dallas. Hi, Joe.
Hi, yeah, this is Joe from Dallas. Philosophers and historians speak of the need in a society or civilization for a spiritual foundation, like Europe moved from Christianity into Rousseau's idea of progress, and China had one time a Confucian morality based on discipline, and then they went to Marxism, which has been being destroyed. And the question is, what is going to be the ultimate spiritual foundation of China? Roman Catholicism and other Christian religions have been making inroads, and I was wondering what your observation would be in terms of what's going to happen. What could be the future spiritual foundation?
Well, that's an excellent question. This is a question that many Chinese intellectuals are asking themselves these days. Communism or Marxism was essentially a state religion. And since that has essentially collapsed, even though there's still the Communist Party, communism as an ideology is essentially bankrupt in China. There's been this search for values there, for spirituality, as you say. There's been a rise in practicing religions. Christianity is one that has benefited, but certainly traditional Chinese religions have also seen large numbers of new adherents. But right now, I just think it's unclear, and I think a lot this is going to interplay with the struggle for the country's future. What kind of political system it embraces is going to affect what kind of values that these people have.
Why the particular emphasis on destroying Falun Gong? Is it just simply the size of the faith?
Well, it was yes. The size was a key factor. The level of organization and primarily it was an organized force that appeared to be not in the control of the party, and this scares the party. They've begun to allow some NGOs to emerge. Some pieces of civil society are starting to appear, but really, when it comes to organized groups of people with large numbers, it doesn't matter if it's a religion or a labor union. They're going to be determined to crush it, and that's what they did to Falun Gong. It'll be interesting to see what other types of movements emerge.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. My guest is Philip P. Pan. His book is called Out of Mao's Shadow, The Struggle for the Soul of a New China. Let's speak next to John in Dallas. Hi, John.
Hi, Chris and Phil. Over the past few months, we've been inundated. And like last night, I watched Bill Moore's or Charlie Rose interview Ted Koppel, who has a new series, read Rob Gifford's China Road book. There's everywhere you turn, there's China specials, documentaries, that type of thing. A common premise seems to be that in order for the state, the party, to maintain power, it's got to urbanize the population to be true to the revolution, to get people out of poverty. But yet, at the same time, they're trampling on the people in the country, with the Three Gorges and things like that. Many of the people that they're looking to save or promote are getting marginalized once again, mainly the agricultural peasant. And my question, you feel, is are they in a catch-22, or can they really urbanize rapidly enough without destroying the rural base in terms of trampling on them to achieve what they want to achieve over the next 50 or 100 years? And do you agree with the premise, I guess?
Well, I think they're just going to continue trampling on the peasants. And they've been doing so for many years, and many decades, many centuries, and if you want to take the long view, and that hasn't necessarily affected the stability of the government. And so, there's basically a two-class system in China right now. The peasants, when they move to the cities, they don't have the same rights to benefits and even political rights as urban residents. They face discrimination in the economy as well. And so, this is a tough challenge for any country. The numbers of people moving to the cities, I think it's over 200 million already now. And this is, urbanization is a tough process. The government has managed it so far pretty smoothly. They don't have huge slums emerging, and they don't have a really huge urban underclass emerging yet. Whether they can keep that up as the numbers increase, I think, is going to be a major challenge, especially for an authoritarian state.
And to be clear, it's not only the government that seems willing to sort of trample on the peasant class, but anyone who reaches the middle class, I shouldn't say anyone, but that discrimination also comes in a sort of social way.
Sure, there's social discrimination, and it can be deep-rooted. At the same time, you'd be surprised, I think, how many people in the cities are sympathetic to the peasant cause. Many of the people in the cities have roots in the countryside as well. And so, for example, there was a book published by two journalists a few years ago that exposed some of the corruption of the countryside. Basically, you have a situation where party officials have unchecked power, and you have taxation without representation, you have abuses of the one-child policy, and you have all sorts of corruption. This was exposed in a book that somehow managed to get published. It was quickly banned a few months later, but it became a bestseller. People across the cities who are the main market for this book, they ate it up, and I think that shows that there's not only a great interest but also a sympathy to what's happening in the countryside.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next to another John, also in Dallas. Hi, John.
Hi. In a book called The Zero Sum Society by Lester Thoreau, he compares Japan and America, and he says that in America, it's essentially every special interest against every other special interest. He says because we can't work together, that creates problems in trying to get anything accomplished that's really good for the entire country. And Japan has been way more successful at this. That's one reason their industry is so much more successful in a lot of ways than ours, because they apportion, when they make a decision, any kind of decision like that always has winners and losers.
Mm-hmm.
And the government tries to make sure that the losers get compensated. And I just wonder if you see China heading more towards, the path that the United States is on, or the path that Japan is on?
Well, this is a good question, and I think what kind of political system emerges that will determine that. I'll tell you what the situation looks like now. I think you have a group of special interests who are basically in bed with the party, and they fight it out among themselves for the riches and for over government policy, but they work with the party to keep the party in power. You have a large majority of the public, though, is not a member of these special interest groups, and they're pushing to have a greater voice. So how this all settles out is going to be interesting to watch.
People might think about the intellectual class in China as having been the one that has fought a lot of these fights, but one of the most interesting chapters I think that you have in the book is about a blind peasant who has worked incredibly hard and sacrificed unbelievable things in order to fight against the one-child policy.
Yeah, he's one of my favorite characters. His name is Chen Guancheng. He was a blind peasant in a village in Shandong province, not far from where Confucius was born. He came to me in Beijing one of my last years, I guess, there, and told me that the people in his village and in the villages surrounding his village were being victimized by party officials enforcing the one-child policy, that women who were pregnant with their second or third child, even if they were in their seventh or eighth or ninth month of pregnancy, they were being forced to have abortions, that couples were being forced to be sterilized. And if people refused to submit to these operations, that neighbors and relatives were being taken hostage, essentially, by party officials and sometimes beaten. He came to me. He said he wanted to file a class action lawsuit. To be a blind man in China is not an easy fate. There are very little services for people with disabilities, and for the blind in particular, your options in education are limited. They just don't have a lot of books translated into Braille. He managed to go to college, but he was forced to study. There's only really two courses of study for blind people. You can become a doctor of traditional medicine, or you can become a masseuse. But on the side, he took a few courses in the law. He taught himself something about the law, and he realized that he understood that what was happening in the village was really a violation of the law. The party has a one-child policy, but it's not supposed to be enforced in this way. So he wanted to file a class action lawsuit. I thought it was a great story, and we had a long talk about whether he was willing to take the risk of exposing this, because we could anticipate that there could be consequences for him. He decided it was important enough for me to write about it. He wanted the international attention and pressure. And in the end, when we wrote the story, the crackdown stopped. But a year later, when he came to visit me again, I actually saw him get arrested. A couple of thugs threw him into a car and forced him in the back seat down on the floor and drove away. And he's still in custody today.
Are you able to have any contact with him?
No, I not directly. You don't get to visit people in Chinese prisons, but I have been able to communicate with him through his family, who has been allowed to visit, and also his lawyers have been allowed to visit. He's expressed no remorse. He still believes what he did was right, but he has a deep and this burning sense of rage at the fact that he's been arrested for essentially standing up for people's rights. He's quite furious about it, and it'll be interesting to see what happens to him when he's released from prison. I think he was sentenced for 3 to 5 years, so he'll be out eventually.
Philip P. Pan is my guest. He is former Beijing bureau chief for the Washington Post. He's just written a book called Out of Mao's Shadow, The Struggle for the Soul of a New China. We'll return to our conversation in a moment, and we'd love to have you join us. The telephone number is 1-800-933-5372. You can also reach us via email. That goes to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think is made possible by SMU's Master of Liberal Studies program, a way to keep your greatest two tools, creativity and curiosity, sharp. Details online at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is journalist Philip P. Pan. He has just finished a 7-year tour as bureau chief in China for the Washington Post. His new book is called Out of Mao's Shadow, The Struggle for the Soul of a New China. Our number is 1-800-933-5372, or you can send email to us at think@kera.org. Clearly, Phil, there is a balance that has to be struck in a one-party state that has shown some flexibility, some ability to change and open things up a little bit, between placing effective pressure on that government and pushing so hard that they're going to come crashing back and put in new sanctions against the people.
Yeah, so the government's walked this tightrope pretty well. It's interesting, when they back down, well, I'll give you an example. The recent earthquake in Sichuan, their initial response was to issue an edict to all the journalists in the country not to cover the earthquake. It's not that they wanted to cover it up. They wanted to control the message. And so they told journalists across the country not to go out there. But immediately, journalists across the country ignored the edict and went, and they covered the story. And that resulted in a faster government response to the earthquake, a more effective response, I believe, and also it made the government look better because the media was able to show the premier, Wen Jiabao, and the president, Hu Jintao, on the scene. In some ways, they looked much more effective than President Bush did after the Hurricane Katrina. And so if the party had acted if it had been able to get its way, it would have, been hurt much more by this earthquake. Instead, it was forced to back down. People, journalists in particular, were able to get more freedom. But the the party also ends up on top as well, because it's strengthened. You know, a government that's more democratic, more open, more tolerant is going to be a more effective government, and that will make the one-party system stronger.
There were some evaluations when that first happened that the government learned its lesson in the SARS era. Do you think that's true?
Well, I don't think it's learned its lesson. I think some officials in the government understand this interplay, that if they can act more openly, more democratically, that they'll do better, and that may even prolong the life of the party itself. But I think most of the leaders, their instinct has always been to preserve the one-party state, and that the best way to preserve it is to clamp down. So you have this back and forth, I think, even within the leadership, and you know, even within individual leaders, I think, they sometimes say, well, this is our strategy. You know, we'll clamp down for a little while, and then we'll open up for a little while, and then we'll clamp down again. And they see this as their best way to stay in power, and it's been effective so far.
I know you've been quite busy working as bureau chief covering a country as large as China, but I'm wondering if you've been able to do much monitoring of the kind of coverage that other international correspondents do in China. For example, a story that would interest the Washington Post and how that might differ from a publication in London or Vietnam or Mexico or some other place that might have correspondents working in Beijing.
Well, that's a good question. I have to admit, I don't have a lot of time to read what's written, especially in other languages. But I think generally the coverage has been pretty good out of China by the foreign correspondents there. Most of the correspondents there now do speak Chinese, and they you know, that gives them much greater access than I think previous generations of correspondents who didn't. So I think generally the coverage has been pretty good. I think international the foreign media faces similar challenges that the American media is facing, that with the market pressures and the pressures from the internet, it's becoming there's less resources devoted to foreign news and there's less space devoted to foreign stories, and so we all face those types of challenges, I think.
How did you prepare yourself for the assignment? You had studied Chinese at Peking University, is that right?
That's right. I studied Chinese in Peking University after college in the early 90s, not long after the 89 massacre, and that experience really helped inform my reporting when I returned to China as a correspondent 8 years later. Before coming to China, obviously, I had some time to prepare. The Post allowed me to spend a few months trying to brush up on my Chinese and also on current events in China, obviously. But a lot of the Chinese I learned on the job in China, and I think by the time I left, I was able to conduct interviews. People really, unless I identified as myself, wouldn't be able to tell that I was necessarily a foreigner.
That had to have made some kinds of stories easier.
Of course, yeah. Mm-hmm. It allows me to sneak around a little bit better. We assume that our phones are tapped. There's really no risk to us working there, personal risk to us working there. But there is risk to the people we interview. The blind man I spoke about was an example of what can happen to the people we interview. Sometimes security services want to prevent interviews, and we'll arrest people before we can talk to them. So we have to be careful. But, being ethnic Chinese, it allowed me to move around in a way that I think other correspondents couldn't. For example, I was able to get into a courtroom and watch a four-day libel trial unfold. A party official had sued the authors of that book I mentioned about the countryside, and I was able to, sort of dress down, try to pretend to be a peasant and sit in the back of the courtroom and watch the whole trial, which was a really amazing experience for me.
And your next gig for the Post is in Moscow, is that right?
That's right. I'm studying Russian now, and I'll be moving to Moscow in August.
I know that when you first came as bureau chief to Beijing, the announcement had just been made about the Olympics, and I'm curious about whether it's bittersweet for you to have left just before that all came to fruition, or if you're thinking, thank God I'm out of there.
Well, I have mixed feelings about it. Obviously, I miss the story. I miss China. I would have liked to have been there covering the events in Tibet recently and the earthquake, of course. I have a lot of friends who live in Sichuan province and friends in Lhasa as well. The Olympics, I always knew that I would be leaving before the Olympics. It's going to be a major event, but it's also going to be a lot of work, so I'm a little bit relieved as well. I was there in 2001 when they announced that the city was going to have the honor of hosting the Olympics. And I was on the streets that night when hundreds of thousands of people poured into the streets celebrating. It was really a spontaneous celebration in many ways because the government had posted police around Tiananmen Square to try to prevent people from getting in, but the crowd pushed through and they partied late into the night. And for me, it was a really jarring experience because the last time a crowd of that size had occupied the square was in 1989 during the pro-democracy demonstrations. And that night really led me to ask the questions that led to this book. You know, what happened to the people's demands for democratic change? How long can this party stay in power? And how has it been so successful at making people forget what happened?
On or before June 4th of every year, the party arrests people or puts them under surveillance who had anything to do with the demonstrations at Tiananmen Square.
Yeah, every year on the anniversary, certainly, actually, you're right. In the weeks before the anniversary, they begin to tighten things up. People who are have ties to what happened in 1989, they put under greater surveillance. They put them in jail or under house arrest. You know, this is an example of how history remains a battlefield. You know, it's important to the party that people don't think about Tiananmen because it really was a turning point. You know, the party, if it had been more moderate in its response, the students, if they had been more moderate in their demands, you know, perhaps China would have taken a different course then. And, you know, this is not a subject that the party wants people discussing. And so they try very hard to limit it, but I don't think they've been completely successful.
How worrisome is it that there isn't even really, there's an official history that completely, I guess, eliminates this. The fact that there's not even a record that people can be sort of officially going to and that the story of Tiananmen Square is essentially kept alive by people who perhaps weren't there or weren't Chinese, is that troublesome?
It is. It is troublesome for society, I think, to forget something like that. But I don't think everyone's forgotten. You know, it's a little different than the Cultural Revolution. Half of the population was born after the Cultural Revolution ended. But a lot of people in China now were alive and were following the events of 1989. And we sometimes forget that these protests weren't limited to just Beijing, but they occurred all across the country. And so in 2005, Zhao Ziyang, who had been the head of the party in 1989, he had been purged for refusing to order the crackdown. He was placed under house arrest for the rest of his life, 15 years. At his funeral, which the party tried to hush up, thousands of people from across the country came to his funeral. You know, I was there, and I talked to these people, and I was really inspired by them because there was really nothing in it for them to come to this man's funeral. But they saw him as a symbol for another path that China could have taken, and they wanted to honor that. And it was a reminder to me that, you know, some people say that Chinese people aren't interested in politics; they only care about making money now. But that funeral was a reminder that just isn't true.
And even the perception, do you think that will ultimately swing like the pendulum swings? In other words, it's for the first time, you know, for the past couple of decades, Chinese people have had the opportunity to make money. At some point, that's got to, the desire for that's got to abate a little bit, don't you think?
Well, I don't know about that. You know, I think everyone, it's very human to want to prosper and to do well for your family.
To the exclusion of other things, though?
No, to the exclusion of other things, that becomes the issue. And I think it goes to, you know, whether this government can provide those other things. Certainly, you know, prosperity has given people much greater freedom. They have much greater access to information, and they have much greater freedom in terms of their personal lives. As I said, as we discussed, you know, the party's out of the workplace. Now people can marry who they want. They can live where they want if they can afford it. But the government hasn't been able to deliver, or I should say they're struggling to deliver other public goods. I think most basic one is justice. You know, the courts are controlled by the party, and I think people get frustrated sometimes with that. And I think it'll be, I think you're right, the pendulum will swing in the other direction at some point. But I don't think it's inevitable. I think it happens because of individuals who are pushing for it.
We talked earlier about pressure to sort of maintain a line between not pushing back too hard against the government. What about international pressure? Can you talk about how that plays itself out in terms of countries like the United States trying to pressure China to change its human rights standards or to behave differently toward Tibet?
Well, I think it's a parallel dilemma. You know, the foreign governments, especially the United States, you know, when they speak out on human rights, when they push the government to change its behavior, it can backfire sometimes. The government sometimes uses this as to fan the flames of nationalism and to rally people behind it. Sometimes it can be effective. You know, sometimes the government does respond and back down and behave better. So it's a dilemma. You know, and I don't have an answer to how the U.S. government should be treating these issues. But it's important to remember, I think, that the people in China who are pushing for change face the same dilemmas. You know, they face really difficult decisions about whether to push for change or whether pushing too hard is going to cause a backlash among the hardliners in the party. When that blind man was arrested, there was a movement, really, across the country to try to save him. But it was really racked by internal divisions because the lawyers involved, the journalists involved, they were not agreed. They couldn't agree on what the best strategy was. Some of them wanted to make this an international issue, push it out front and push really hard, attacking the government. Others wanted to play it really quietly. And, you know, this is the challenge right now for the people pushing for change. It's just not clear what the best road is right now.
Is most of that pressure from within China domestic, or are people also looking at China's influence in Sudan and other parts of Africa?
No, it's primarily domestic. The only international impact or international influence over this movement may be, like, as you said before, people watching television and seeing how other nations are governed. But particularly, I think people also watch what's happening in Taiwan. And, you know, the government says Taiwan is part of China, and many people in China agree with this. But they also watch Taiwan because they see that there's a democracy there. They see that the people of Taiwan have recently elected a new president, a young, charismatic man who gives interviews, who does press conferences, who seems like a real leader. And it's very easy for them to draw the contrast with the sort of colorless state bureaucrats who run the state in China.
Which unfortunately sounds like maybe something that would limit the sort of detente that we've seen between China and Taiwan recently.
Well, it's going to be fascinating to watch because this detente is important. For a long time, the Nationalist Party, which is the party that just won the presidency in Taiwan, was vilified in mainland China because this was the party that the communists defeated in the revolution. But the emergence of a pro-independence movement in Taiwan, another party represented by another party, has led the mainland government to really rehabilitate the Nationalist Party. They really welcomed this man's election. But it's like I said, I think it's a double-edged sword for the government. You know, they have a president now in Taiwan who is not going to be pushing for political independence the way the previous president did. But he's also, I think that debate over independence allowed the government to distract people from the other issue of democracy versus authoritarianism.
Philip Pepin spent 7 years as bureau chief of the Washington Post Beijing Bureau. His new book is called Out of Mao's Shadow, The Struggle for the Soul of a New China. Phil, it's been fascinating. Thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, thanks for having me. I hope you enjoy the book.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thank you for listening and have a great day.
Think is produced by Jeff Whittington and engineered by Jeannie Mascoro. Learn about upcoming programs, subscribe to our free daily podcast, and order CD copies of your favorite Think shows on the radio page of KERA.org. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@KERA.org.